congressional Republicans in the U.S. House have released the American Healthcare Act, their plan for overhauling the current healthcare law. Under the Affordable Care Act, Alaska has the highest healthcare costs in the nation and receives the largest subsidies. How would that change under the proposed legislation? A new report from the Congressional Budget Office says it depends on who you are. I'm Lori Townsend. Stay with us to find out more on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, this is Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing the potential impacts of the proposed replacement for the Affordable Care Act on Alaskans. Detractors say it will cost some Alaskans thousands of dollars each year, and at least 14,000 people will lose coverage in the state. We'll look at how it could impact premiums and the number of people who have health coverage. In the studio with me today is Becky Hultberg. Becky is the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Hello, Becky.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Also in the studio is Joshua Weinstein. Joshua is with North Rim Benefits Group and Enroll Alaska, an organization that helped Alaskans sign up for insurance under the ACA. Welcome, Joshua.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here, both of you. And for listeners out there, do you have questions about how the proposed replacement for the Affordable Care Act might impact you? Did you gain coverage under the ACA or lose it? Let us know. Give us a call statewide, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So there's a lot to cover. Before we drill down in the details, I'd like your kind of initial reactions to what's emerged. The Congressional Budget Office says there will be winners and losers. The CBO estimates millions, perhaps as many as 24 million, will lose coverage or elect to drop it if the mandate goes away. But the federal government will save more than $300 billion. Becky, let's start with you. A letter from hospital associations and medical colleges used language like tremendous instability, likely to result in substantial reduction in the number of Americans who can afford insurance. The word concerned was used, I think, three times. Finally saying the association cannot support the legislation as currently written. Break down the concerns for us, Becky, from the association's perspective.
Sure. I think there are two buckets of concerns when you look at the act at a very, very high level. There are probably many more that could be identified, but the two that I think are most prominent are, the first is that is how will the bill impact the individual market? The bill changes from the current subsidy to a tax credit formula, and I'm sure we'll get into this more in detail, and Josh can probably articulate this much better than I can, given that it's his area of expertise. But there are concerns about whether that formula will work nationwide, and specifically what would the impacts on Alaska be. I think the second big bucket of concern is around the Medicaid program. And the bill makes significant changes to both the overall Medicaid program, really changing the formula for states by which Medicaid funding is determined. And it also rolls back Medicaid expansion beginning in 2020. So both of those alone would be significant policy changes. But together, they are really a remaking of the entire Medicaid program.
All right. Thank you so much for that. And Joshua Weinstein, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price said the CBO did not take regulatory reform into account. Is much known yet about what he means by what that reform would do and how it may help improve the prospects for this bill?
recognize that the CBO projections are just that, they're projections. And historically, they do a better job at looking at deficit or surplus issues from a dollars in, dollars out basis for us as taxpayers and what legislation has an impact in the Treasury. Regarding the predictions on who or who will not have insurance, how the uninsured rate is affected, they've been off. And that's, I think, a lever that the Trump administration is pulling on to discredit the figures coming out of the CBO, talking about 14 million Americans will lose the health insurance in just two short years, less than that, and spiraling to over 24 million Americans just a few years later. As far as the regulatory changes, I believe what they're playing to is the acknowledgement or recognition that if there's not a mandate for individuals to carry insurance and therefore a tax penalty that applies today would go away, that some people who were getting insurance really to just avoid the tax penalty would say, I'm going to drop it for the same reason I got it, which was some type of fiscal measure versus truly protection in the event of, you know, getting ill or injured. I think other regulatory aspects look at the employer markets and did employers behave differently with respect to offering coverage because they might be penalized for failure to provide full-time employees an offer of coverage, and how would that impact? So with respect to, you know, the CBO's scoring, I think they are there's some accuracy there that there will be a loss of coverage, whether or not it's because people celebrate that they don't have to carry it anymore or because truly they can't afford it anymore is really what remains up for greater debate. I could inject my own observations on that and
we'll
probably get into greater detail, but kind of to tag along with what Becky was going into a bit is the Alaska market has been in trouble for a long time, and I'm talking primarily to the individual insurance market where over 20,000 Alaskans today get coverage. And the main financing mechanism of our individual market has been a combination of various government supports. In fact, for 2017 and 2018, the state of Alaska is actually reinsuring and bringing down the cost of health insurance for our sole remaining carrier, the Premier Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. So even if you're buying insurance without a subsidy, your rate is already subsidized in part by some state-level support to bring the premiums down through what's called reinsurance. On top of that, already, you know, somewhat reduced number, is that individuals were getting help through these advanced premium tax credits that were linked to an individual's income and household size. And what it did is it set the bar that based on your income and your household size, you would be limited to pay a certain percentage of your income for a benchmark plan. And that could be as low as 2% up to around 9%, you know, and it's fractional of your income. So essentially, you could buy a good health insurance product based on your income for less than 10% of your income. And the less you made, the lower your percentage threshold was. So we've been enrolling people with plans for $40 a month, you know, and all over the place. You know, some had zero, some had 100 plus, but they were getting significant premium support. The next level of help that would change is that once you're enrolled in a health plan as an individual, you can't necessarily afford a several thousand dollar deductible or huge out-of-pocket expenses if you do actually need to use your benefit of the insurance plan. And so there was additional reductions in deductibles and out-of-pocket limits for some of the low to moderate income individuals. So this sort of triple support system of the state providing lower premiums for everyone, the tax credits to lower it to be a function of your income, and then further reducing your deductible and out-of-pocket expense is what has allowed Alaska's individual insurance market to remain, and I say this sort of liberally, semi-functional. And under the proposed legislation that's coming out of the House, a lot would change. And I would not disagree with really a disastrous consequence if this bill became law. A really honed-in study focused in on Alaska, and right now we are, as a state, receiving on average over $11,000 on average for each enrollee marketplace consumer. So it's $11,600 in 2017. That number would come down significantly, and that compares to about $4,600 nationally. So we're already, you know, more than double the recipients of these federal tax dollars. the new program under the AHCA is proposing tax credits based on age that would be between $2,000 and $4,000. So significant reduction in help from or supports from the federal government for individual consumers would just translate into unaffordable premiums and really just instability in an already unstable market.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the healthcare overhaul, the U.S. House plan, the American Healthcare Act to replace the Affordable Care Act. You were just talking about the difference in age demographics when it comes to premium. The Congressional Budget Office says that premiums would go up for a few years, then come down, but primarily for younger and middle age people. Older people would see higher premiums. Where is the age breakdown, and how did that? Why is that in this new legislation? Who wants to take that, Joshua?
I believe you're referencing what they're called the age bands. And so, as we all probably could make sense, that older individuals use more health care, more costly to insure than younger consumers or policy owners. The ratio of that risk is naturally about 5 to 1. So, for example, someone in their early 60s costs about 5 times as much for health care expenses, whether it's prescription drugs, hospitals, doctors, all those, you know, costs, than a 21-year-old adult. So that would be a natural rate, you know, would be 5 times higher for that 64-year-old than that 21-year-old. And the current law limits that ratio to 3 to 1. And so what that does is artificially increases the rate for younger people and underrepresents what the older person is paying. When we think about insurance and risk pools and spreading who should, you know, who we need to cover, the most desirable populations are the younger, typically healthier, lower cost individuals. And so they've been the ones having to face the largest increases because they're supporting the older folks. So the law would allow states to actually set their own age bands. And 5 to 1 would be the default unless a state requests some other ratio. I think in its outset, that is not a market destabilizer. In fact, it may provide greater value by making health insurance more affordable for typically younger, healthier, and lower earners. We tend to make more money as we get older. So I can support that particular component. But when you look at a marketplace where the average health insurance premium over the course of a year in 2020, when these changes would be, the tax credits would change under the proposed legislation, our average premium is over $1,000 a month in Alaska. And that's just taking all ages spread across. If your tax credit's worth between $2,000 and $4,000 of that, that leaves a very large sum to be paid. And that's for one person. So then go ahead and multiply a family of 4 or 5, and you just arrive at a spot where people can't afford to be insured.
I think there's one other component of this new bill that's worth discussing regarding the individual market, and that is the concept of a guaranteed issue. One of the things that the public liked about the Affordable Care Act from the very beginning and always pulled really high was that you could get coverage even if you had a pre-existing condition.
Right.
And so this law changes that. It maintains guaranteed issue, but if you don't have continuous coverage, you're going to have to pay a penalty of 30%, which in and of itself is destabilizing because they're for people who are potentially don't think they need health insurance, who are relatively healthy, is it worth it in a high-cost market to buy coverage or just to wait until you get sick and then buy coverage and pay 30% more? So I think that is an area of this bill that really needs some scrutiny because I don't think that it is going to help make our market more stable.
This is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the healthcare overhaul and what it will mean for Alaskans if this new legislation, the American Healthcare Act, gets passed into law. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions or concerns about the current legislation, the Affordable Care Act that's known as Obamacare, or what is being worked on in Congress right now. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We are going to go to the phones, and Gray Fox is in Wasilla. Hi, Gray.
Hello there.
Did you have a question?
Yes, I am retired, and I'm on Medicare, and I'm also disabled. And after losing the senior benefits, now I qualify for the Medicaid, that part that pays for my Medicare Part D. And I'm wondering what the chances are if I might lose that Medicaid coverage, because glaucoma eye drops are insanely expensive. They're like $100 for a teaspoon if you have to pay for it out of pocket.
I think that's a very good question. And the answer right now is that we don't exactly know what the impacts of these changes would be, because much of the responsibility would be pushed to states.
I see.
I think it's important, you know, to recognize that there are really is an objective here that's perhaps not articulated when you look at the bill. And that is that there's clearly the desire to push risk for healthcare costs down onto the states, for the federal government to push that financial risk to states. Because if you move to a per capita cap form of Medicaid, essentially, if your spending is above that cap, then the state has to eat that cost. So it's a big change in how Medicaid is financed, and it's really giving states more choice, but also asking them to take significantly more risk. So from a provider standpoint, looking at the reactions to this part of the legislation to date, there's a significant amount of skepticism and concern about that, what that would mean for the future of the Medicaid program. But there is no change now. So for people who are listening to this, please don't be concerned that anything is going to happen imminently. This bill is going to take a long time. There's uncertainty about politically how this bill gets passed, and then many of these changes, even if this bill passed, would be several years in the future.
Well, that's good. The current system is working just fine for everyone in my family. I just hope the new alligators in the swamp don't manage to mess it up too badly. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Gray. So currently, how is Medicaid meted out to the states? Is it block grants, or how does Medicaid payments get made to the states, and how would that change under this proposal?
So Medicaid is essentially a matching type program. The federal and there are people. Medicaid is an incredibly complicated program. So I'm just going to hit the high, you know, sort of the high level points. But Medicaid is essentially a matching type program where the federal government creates the program, gives states some flexibility and choices, but is generally setting the rules for the program. There are different, and then the states can enroll populations, and the federal government matches those funds depending on what category of enrollee it is. Some categories have higher matching rates, or what the state's overall matching rate is. It's called the FMAP, the federal matching. It's essentially a federal matching rate. So for Alaska, that's 50% for your average Medicaid beneficiary, but again, some populations have a higher match. But basically, the way the program is structured now is the state enrolls people, is responsible for paying for a certain percentage of their care, and the federal government pays the other percent, whether costs go up, whether costs go down, whether enrollment goes up, whether enrollment goes down. So changing to a per capita cap type approach is a very significant change, because then if costs go up, but the cap does not go up along with costs, the state will be responsible for that difference. And the bill contemplates using the medical consumer price index as the benchmark for the cap going up. But I think historically, costs have risen faster than the medical CPI. So as an example of a huge risk, if there's a new blockbuster drug that is a miracle drug, but it's incredibly expensive, and a lot of people take advantage of it, that wouldn't be captured in a per capita cap system. And so the state would really be paying for the increased in costs related to that drug.
Mm-hmm. Joshua.
I think it's fair to, and maybe it's imperative to note that what we're talking, what I hear this conversation about is how to essentially dole out and federal taxpayer dollars to pay for healthcare services, whether it's for Medicare, Medicaid, tax credits, or other different programs. And the ideology of, you know, from a whether conservative or liberal or somewhere on that spectrum of, you know, whose responsibility is it to pay for healthcare services ultimately? I think underneath all of that political debate and kind of sort of philosophical, you know, construct of, you know, is it the government's role to pay for people's healthcare, or is it, you know, via tax dollars? And so we're passing the hat for those who are sicker, or is it something, if I want insurance, I'll go buy it? Underneath all of that is that the cost of healthcare and the efficiency and the overall population health in our country does not seem to be making its way through into the conversation enough, in my opinion, in all of this legislative work, which is that, as some of us do know and work, you know, closely with, is that, you know, as Americans, our health is not what it should be. We don't mm-hmm. take care of ourselves. We don't move enough. We don't eat properly. That drives healthcare costs. We live longer, but we don't live as well as we should. We have this mentality as a society that we should get any kind of healthcare that's available. So if we want to see specialists, there's a reluctance to go kind of through what I might refer to as sort of, you know, starting with certain types of healthcare and working your way through the system. We want to see specialists. We want access to the newest imaging technologies, the newest medications and treatments that will prolong our life and not make us suffer, not make us hurt. There's a great cost to innovation and providing all of this new, radical new drugs like you referred to, Betsy. Some of them are life-changing. But I think it's a challenge when we figure out how do we pay for this as a society. And what I'm gathering from the Republican sort of sentiment is that the current model is not sustainable. That if we were to continue on the track of just paying for healthcare, whatever it is, through matching formulas and sort of these subsidies that are connected to the cost of care, well, if we don't address the cost of care by, one, needing less of it as a society because we learn to, you know, need less, taking better care of ourselves, initiatives there that should healthier people be charged less than those who are ill. You know, all these are philosophical questions, but needing to bring down the cost of health care is incumbent because that's what drives the cost of Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance, et cetera. And I don't see enough of that. I just see dollars moving back and forth. And I think that's just a bigger conversation that needs to occur.
And I'm glad you raised that because we have someone here. Becky Hultberg is the CEO, the president CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association. What is your response, Becky, to that idea that the cost of healthcare has to come down, that maybe we should be working the other side of this issue?
We actually would very much agree with that statement. And one of the criticisms of the original Affordable Care Act is that it addressed coverage, but it didn't address cost. But this bill really is not addressing the cost side either. It's just rolling back some of the coverage. And from the perspective of some of my members, we cover those costs when they're not covered another way, because we will see anyone in the emergency room, regardless of their ability to pay. That is both a moral imperative and a federal mandate. So when we don't have people with coverage, they will be seen in a hospital, which is not an efficient way to take care of the population. But back to, I think, Josh's point and your original question, we absolutely all in the healthcare industry have to work on the question of affordability. We have to work on it from a provider standpoint, hospital providers, specialists, primary care physicians, and we have to work on it from a policy standpoint. So I'm encouraged by conversations at the state level that we're starting to have now that we might not have had 5, 10 years ago around the question of of cost and affordability.
Do you think we're going to go back to the phones here because we're getting some calls stacked up, but do you think that there has to be more emphasis also placed on something that you were talking about, Joshua, which is personal responsibility as far as taking control of your own health and making sure that you're at a proper weight for your size and your age, and that you're eating well and getting the recommended amount of exercise for somebody your age? Should there be more incentives built in to this idea of a legislative overhaul to, if people are doing these things, that they do get better benefits and they do get credits? Shouldn't there be a lot more emphasis placed on that?
I think it'd be hard to argue that and say, of course we should. We should, as a society, work toward better population health, that we shouldn't be the last, you know, at the bottom of the industrialized nations in terms of our health status, however that's calculated, and the cost we spend on healthcare versus the results we get. And so, of course, we should work on those things. And I absolutely agree with Betsy that this bill does not do those things. It is a reconciliation bill that adjusts surplus and deficit. It plays with federal budgetary items. That's all it's allowed to do, because we can't get, I don't even know that we'll get the 51 votes in the Senate that are needed to pass this reconciliation at this point, let alone the 60 that we'd normally need to pass legislation through normal means. So it is all a financial tool that's being played with at this point, taxes and different levers that deal with the budget. I think it's just imperative that we understand that the driving cost of healthcare is bigger than this conversation and this piece of legislation.
Let's go back to the phones. Shelley is in Anchorage. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call this morning. I have a real quick comment, and then I have a question. So I just want to remind everybody that's listening that we spent $700 billion to bail out banks, and I would certainly hope that Congress would remember that and remember what American lives are worth, because that's what this bill is doing. It's just putting a price tag on American lives for some people. But I had a question about a gap in coverage. You guys were talking about penalties earlier, and it seems like under this bill, a penalty would have to be paid if you had a gap in coverage. So even if you decided you didn't want health care, if this was passed and you were a young person, but then you wanted to get on health care later, it seems like you could be charged 30% of whatever that plan would cost, and that would be paid to the insurance company. So am I understanding that right? And could you talk a little bit about that? And I'll take my answer off the air. So thank you very much.
Joshua?
Sure. Good question. So we need insurers to participate in this model. As it currently exists, insurance companies finance the bulk of healthcare in this country. It's either governmental programs or through employers. Those are the big payers of healthcare. In the case of employers and individuals in the private segment, insurance companies are the big bad word that comes to mind of how we do that. And in order to have insurance companies say, yes, we will enter a market and enroll subscribers, whether it's through employer markets or individual markets, they need to be able to price for risk. They need to understand that they have some control. So if we don't have a mandate that says everyone needs coverage, then what else can we do to prohibit and prevent people from just getting coverage when they're sick? And so the mindset is, if we want to have guaranteed issue, that means you cannot be denied coverage when you have a pre-existing condition. You will have coverage for that pre-existing condition. So one lets you into the plan, the other one covers your pre-existing conditions. We want that, and I think there's no proposed changes to that. That is a very popular concept going forward and has been since the days of the ACA. Well, how do you... then insurers will say, well, we need some protection there in order for us to play. And that is that if you don't enroll during your open enrollment period and have had maintained coverage continuously, and they allow a 63-day gap, but that's what they call continuous coverage, then we will surcharge your premium for 12 months up to 30%. So it's not a forever surcharge, and it is a surcharge for not having paid into the system, again, with, you know, unless you had more than a 63-day gap, then you wouldn't have that surcharge.
Is it the same as a tax?
It is a penalty, because someone who's coming into coverage who has not had health insurance generally has a health issue that needs to get paid for. That's kind of what it is. It's a way to pay for those, that the risk of people coming into the plan that haven't had coverage for at least 63 days, because they're generally going to present with something that needs to be paid for. But those who carry continuous coverage, don't have that same presentation of risk.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about the American Healthcare Act and the changes to national healthcare legislation on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the overhaul of national healthcare legislation, the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act with something called the American Healthcare Act. I have Becky Hultberg, who is the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, in the studio, and also Joshua Weinstein, who is with Northrim Benefits Group and Enroll Alaska. We are going to go back to the phones now. Libby is in Fairbanks. Oh, Libby is no longer on the line. So let's go to Jim in Wasilla. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I retired recently, and my retirement plan had the company I worked for had a Cadillac insurance coverage. And soon after the Affordable Care Act came into effect, I was dropped off of my nice retirement health care plan and put out there with all the rest of the folks. So now I can't afford, I'm 71. I don't have any medical issues. I'm not on any prescriptions other than I need some dental. So my option is to go to Mexico. And hopefully that great wall of Trump being built doesn't keep Americans walled in. And that's what I think it's for, is to keep us from going to Mexico to get cheaper and better medical coverage, because that's what I'm going to have to do and move out of state. I can't afford to live here if I have something go haywire.
You know, Jim, I'm really glad that you called, because we've got the experts in here that can maybe help us understand why things like that happened. That was one of the damaging issues that came out of the Affordable Care Act. Was President Obama said, if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. If you like your plan, you can keep your plan. Oops, that didn't happen for a lot of people. Jim's an illustration of that. Joshua, what's going on there? Why did that happen?
Well, every employer that decides to provide a retiree benefit, and most commonly now that's government entities like the school districts or the state's government, or private employers, large Fortune 500 companies, are looking at strictly the cost of providing a retiree health benefit, and many are moving away from that type of program or scaling them back, much like they did the old pension plans and moving towards a 401k type of approach, just out of financial, discipline in their view. Jim, I presume you have Medicare, parts A and B and the D, the different pieces and parts of Medicare that cover your health care if you needed it. There is no dental coverage in that program, so I understand the sentiment there that when you need dental work, you're out of pocket on that one, or you could choose to go elsewhere out of state if you wanted to. I'm not sure I really understood your question is why is it that employers dropped the big fancy plans for retirees or even their active employees? Is I believe it's a function of cost.
So did it not have anything to do with the ACA?
Well, the ACA threatened that if these Cadillac plans, and we've heard that term tossed around, if a plan was too good because it cost too much, that there would be an excise tax imposed. Mm-hmm. That tax was slated to take effect in 2018, was pushed back till 2020, and the the House bills is proposing to move it out further to 2025. So that tax never took effect, but it maybe gave employers a potential scapegoat to say, okay, now's the time to blame it on the law that we can't do this anymore, and that's what's happening. So there have been many unfortunate recipients of, you know, the notice that their employer retiree health plan is no longer and that they're in Medicare now.
Interesting. Well, thank you, Jim, for the call. We're going to stick with the phones for just a moment and go to Karen in Petersburg. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've kind of calmed down a little bit because my issue has been I've been trying to follow both programs, what's going on now and the change. And to me, the big question that's always left out of any discussion is the cost of the medical. And we can have, how the insurance companies are still going to have to cover the cost. And if we don't all work on that together and we're all involved, because some people say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this. I don't really need to, but it doesn't cost me anything. But all this is costing all of us, our whole culture. And we're all in it together, and we have to all work together to try to get those costs down on top of, and then the rest of it is whatever. But nothing's going to work until that happens, and we all are in it together. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen. We were talking during the break that Becky had mentioned that there is a federal mandate that hospitals must see everyone who comes to the emergency room. So we have a mandate on the one side that regardless of whether you have insurance or not, regardless of whether you're responsible about how you're taking care of yourself or not, you will be seen. So that's been mandated by the federal government. But now we're seeing that the federal government does not want to mandate that people in response should have insurance. So the two, there's a disconnect there, it seems to me. Becky, what's your take on that?
I think overall, when you look at healthcare, there are disconnects all over the place. So I want to take that in two parts. The first is regarding Karen's comment. Absolutely, we all need to work on the cost issue together. But when we have cost conversations, we often are talking about what providers charge. That is one part of the cost conversation, and it's an important one. But we also need to talk about the cost of our technology. How much are we willing to pay for the latest and greatest imaging or whatever the technology is? Is it going to be, are we as a society willing to pay the continuing and increasing cost of technology? Most of us, I think, would say yes, but it's a part of the cost equation that we don't talk about. And I think the third part of the cost equation is how much care we utilize. And I think that goes back to the earlier comment about, do we use the medical system appropriately, or do we seek the quickest but perhaps highest cost alternative to address our problem? Other countries that have very different patterns of healthcare utilization. And in our country, we tend to spend the most resources at the very end of life and not always in the most efficient way. Those things have to be part of that conversation. On the second point, which is about the odd disconnects we have regarding how we provide healthcare, absolutely, there's a federal act called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act that requires that hospitals will provide an evaluation and stabilizing treatment to anyone who comes into the emergency department for any reason. It is really, as I said, a moral imperative for hospitals because they really believe it's their responsibility to do that. But it's also a huge cost. We are providing healthcare. We're just not providing it always in the most efficient way possible.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about healthcare overhaul, and I want to get to some of those bigger issues about universal care and other countries that have those plans. But let's stick with the phones for just a moment. Don is in Anchorage. Hi, Don.
No, you got the right guy. I used to have pen pals overseas, Denmark and a number of other places aside from the states like Massachusetts had medical coverage. And the people that I wrote and talked to said very plain and simple, the same scenario. When you're young, you hate paying all the darn taxes. When you get older, you break a leg or something, or a kid needs medical care, you're darn glad you've been paying those taxes for all those years when you don't have a bunch of bills hanging over your head. So that was the bottom line I heard in virtually every case. Didn't matter whether it was coming from the UK or some other European country. Japanese, to some extent, use certain principles that are very similar to that. The basic concept is the education is part of it, how well you take care of yourself, development of your attitude towards it. A lot of people said in 1935, when Social Security got passed and kicked into gear, oh, no, it's going to fail. It isn't going to work. Here we are, what, 85 years later, and it's still in position, still working, and still helping more people than ever. I know I'm on it. And it's just the idea that it will work if we really want it to. If we decide we're going to have a lot of friction against it, if we're going to decide we're not going to give it a good hearing, a good chance, and we're not going to leave it open to positive modifications to help retain what is good for the most people involved, yeah, it's going to fail. And we know for over 7 years now, all we've been hearing from the Republicans is, we're going to gut it. It's going to get gone out. We're going to make sure Obama fails. Now, that is about as close to being unpatriotic as you can get as far as accepting American standards are concerned with the intent of what this country was laid out with. We're talking about the good intentions, not the bad ones.
Well, thanks, Don. I want to address some of these things and move us forward here. We've got a lot of other calls on the line, so thanks for your comments. He's talking about, you know, politics over really letting the health care legislation move forward. A lot of people said during the Affordable Care Act debates that maybe it's going to need work, just like civil rights legislation or other bits of national legislation that are massive. It may take years of refining and changing, but now we're looking at a whole new set of circumstances. I've had a couple emails of people wanting to know, why don't we look at a universal plan? That was something that was discussed initially with the ACA, that there would be universal coverage like other countries have. I've heard some people, experts in health, say, as you noted, Joshua, Americans aren't as healthy as they should be, and the cost of a system that's a universal care system might be too massive, and so that might not work. We had an email from John Perkins who said, why hasn't anyone talked about swapping to a healthcare plan like Singapore? He says Bloomberg rates it as the most efficient system in the world. What about this idea of universal care? Becky?
I think that you have to look at the cultural context of healthcare in this country to have that conversation. And we are not a country right now. We are not, as a people, generalizing here, making a broad generalization, ready, I think, to have a conversation about restrictions. And you can't have a universal healthcare system without having some pretty significant restrictions on access. You can't let everyone go to the doctor anytime they want, all the time, for free. That does not work. It would explode costs. So I think there's some validity to the point that if you just transfer our wants and needs into a universal healthcare system, you would have an unaffordable system. Mm. And the question then is really, what is the best next step for us in this country, given our costs? Is it to try to move toward a system that allows some market principles to work more effectively? Or is it to move some other direction? But I think key to that question is our expectations as consumers of our ability to choose and our ability to consume the level of healthcare we want to.
Joshua, did you want to add to that?
I concur. I don't believe there's an appetite for taxpayers, because what would really happen at the payment level of paying for the system is a transference from premiums to taxes to fund healthcare for all. A couple states have put on their ballots over the last decade initiatives to move toward a single payer type of system.
Massachusetts has.
Massachusetts. Colorado voted it down 80% to 20% a few years ago. Oregon's looked at it. I believe there's an initiative in California that's underway, largely state-based attempts to essentially get rid of insurance, you know, remove the insurance companies in between the patients and their doctors, pay the doctors and the hospitals and the, you know, pay for the services via taxes, and everyone can come in, as there's a lot of challenges in doing that. I think there's a lot of pervasive incentives right now in the medical system, various, all the different components in the medical system, many of them run like businesses. So they're looking for long-term sustainable growth and profit. And so there's a, you know, fundamental argument, if you move towards quote-unquote government-run healthcare and we remove profit from the equation, yes, living, everyone can make a living and have, you know, good enough facilities, but we remove some of the incentives of you know, large payouts, windfalls, and other things that are part of, you know, new medical innovations or discoveries or very, very talented surgeons, you know, being rewarded as handsomely as they are now. I think there's just a philosophical change that I don't think societally we're there yet to entertain. And with government-run healthcare comes rationing. And that's, you know, it's basically there's a limited supply and insatiable demand. And so how do we battle that? And I remember a story I overheard in Canada where, you know, hip replacement surgeries, people get hip replacement surgeries, but generally not after a certain age. And not, you know, pending a fall, if there's other comorbidities, if there's other health factors. So in the U.S., we don't question giving my 96-year-old grandmother had a hip replacement surgery. Yeah. That doesn't happen in countries that have socialized health systems. That's not a valuable use of resources, but she got one. So only in America would a 96-year-old get a total hip replacement. So,
well, you know, you were mentioning the rationing aspect, and we have Libby in Fairbanks is back on the line. She has... I think a question about Medicaid expansion in Alaska Natives. And when you talk about rationing, I remember a time when the IHS system, I worked on a reservation and the people that were tribal members would say, you know, toward the end of the month, they run out of everything. And they had really no mechanism for actually taking payments from people who had good employment and could help pay for some of their service. A lot of that's changed now. The Alaska Native Medical Center, the tribal health system is very robust, and it does take insurance, and so there's been growth beyond that sort of rationed care, it seems. Let's hear what Libby has to say from Fairbanks. Hi, Libby.
Hi. I didn't know I had to keep my phone on. Thank you for taking my call. I'm speaking on behalf of all Alaska Natives. I'm 60 years old. I've had 12 surgeries. It looks like I'll need to have the 13th. I'm covered under Alaska Native Health. But when Medicaid expansion came in, we all had to apply for Medicaid. We live in a very limited income. My husband is my caregiver. I want to know how Medicaid expansion and how this new act is going to affect Alaska Native Health and the Alaska Medicaid expansion that was mandated by the governor that all Alaska Natives had to enroll in. And your thoughts on that?
So Medicaid expansion, I think, is one of the things that is a significant change in this bill from the original Affordable Care Act. The bill contemplates essentially rolling expansion back beginning in 2020, mm-hmm. not allowing new enrollees. So because of there are a lot of people who transition off and on Medicaid, there's a lot of what we call churn in that market. It would eventually result in that population going off of Medicaid. That's one of the significant concerns from our standpoint about this bill.
All right, we are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take more calls and more questions as we are discussing the national healthcare legislation and what changes may be coming today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I have an email question here from June, who says, as I understand it, the only federal program that is allowed to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical corporations is the Veterans Administration. Medicare, Medicaid cannot. She says, this must be a major cost. It's not addressed and certainly should be before 14 to 24 million people lose their coverage. Do we know what this new legislation would suggest in that regard as far as negotiations?
I think there are a couple of points to make, and this was a point made earlier, but I think it's important to underscore. This bill right now is limited to those things that have dollars attached to it because it is contemplated that it will pass through the reconciliation process, the budget reconciliation process in Congress. So that means that we're talking a lot about moving money around because that's what the bill can affect. Some of the questions around pharmaceuticals, I think, are bigger policy questions that are going to have to be addressed more than just through the finance mechanism. So I'm not aware of anything specific in this bill that address pharmacy costs. There are many, I think pharmacy is one area where if we made some smart changes to policy, we could see an impact because we have essentially in some ways legalized monopolies for drug companies, and that is why their costs are so high. So I think that is an area really ripe for regulatory type reform where we could, through some reform efforts, see a better outcome in terms of cost and value.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. David is in Anchor Point. Hi, David. You have a question?
Yeah. Hi. Well, actually, I have no question. I have a couple thoughts, though, and thanks for this program. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I retired last year after several years in a position where we had a group statewide plan, and it cost per full-time employee $850 a month, and then there was a $4,000 deductible. So by the time the organization paid for one person's annual health care, it was over $10,000, and it would take me the greater part of that year to just beat the $4,000 deductible down. Now that I'm retired, I'm on the Affordable Care Plan, and it's costing me $100 a month. It is truly affordable, and the coverage so far with Premera is decent. I'd like to see more players in the health care pool to give those of us that are participating a better option. And I'd like to thank Don for his comments. I'm really disappointed that the U.S. lags so far behind in so many nations on the world in providing health care. Congress does not need to reinvent the wheel. They need to just investigate what some of these other countries are doing and have been doing for quite a while and perhaps come up with a plan that makes sense to more of us. But however this all shakes down, I have a suggestion for our representatives and senators in Washington and their employees, and that would be that they be required to participate in any health care program that they put into place for our benefit, in quotes. They need to participate in the program also, so they see what they've created, warts and all, and have to experience that and maybe change their mind a little bit down the road. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, David. We need to keep moving forward. Thanks so much for your comments. I think a lot of people would agree with you that if congressional members had the same plans that they mandate for the rest of the United States, that maybe there would be changes built in there. I did want to get to a question about the individual market. Most Alaskans don't get coverage on the individual market. I think it's fewer than 20,000 people in the state that actually get that kind of coverage. Why does it matter for the state as a whole to have a really robust individual market? Why is that important? Joshua?
Well, it's a little bit more than 20,000, but in and around that figure. David was our last caller. This new piece of legislation would not be good for someone who's retired, but maybe not quite on Medicare. That's not a good win for him. Unfortunately, I know Murkowski just spoke up and said this is a concern for her in terms of her vote pending on this, is that it really, really hurts Alaskans in that market. With respect to why is it important to have an individual market, if you are not eligible for an employer-sponsored plan because you're self-employed. If you are a college student and so you're studying, there's a variety of scenarios where you just don't have access to a company or government-provided health plan. Where would you go? What would you do? Prior to the ACA, you had an individual market. We had four or five players in Alaska, but we had problems. So although the rates were lower, if you weren't healthy, you could be declined coverage. So having a robust, accessible individual market that's affordable rounds out our current fractured healthcare system because you could at least get coverage somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's really key about the individual market is that it enables people to become entrepreneurs if they want to. So I think from an overall economic standpoint, this is a really important market because we want people who are innovators to be able to leave their jobs and the security of employer-based insurance to go out, start their own businesses, and still be able to get insurance coverage. So I think it's a very key market. It may be small in numbers, but I think it's important. I think another point that's really important in this conversation is that there were flaws in the ACA that needed to be addressed. So we've said a lot of things about how this bill is bad for Alaska, and it would be bad for Alaska. But I think it's also important to remember that we need to figure out, regardless of what happens to this bill, how to address some of the problems with the ACA, one of them being the individual market, and especially the small number of people who don't get subsidies and are paying the full cost of insurance premiums in that market, which are extraordinarily high. So we do need, whatever the ultimate disposition of this bill, if this bill does not pass or if it gets amended or whatever, wherever we end up on this road, we need to remember that there are some things in the ACA that needed to be fixed, perhaps not thrown out, but fixed.
Joshua, final thoughts? We have about 30 seconds or so left.
There are some potentially good things in this piece of legislation. And so I just thought it would be worthwhile to note a few of if there's anything in this Republican bill that I could get behind, that I would put my hat in. I think it's more destructive for Alaska than it is good. It does, in my opinion, give employers some greater flexibility. They've been somewhat hampered by having to provide, whether it's bronze, silver, gold plans, there's the opportunity for some greater creativity and flexibility in health plans. That could potentially create more employers offering health insurance, whereas now the bar may be too high in terms of cost. There are lots of repeals of different forms of taxation that will potentially create more capital out for the entrepreneurs to go and grow and be in business. So lots of taxes would fall off. So that could help inject, like I said, more money into the local economy. I don't necessarily believe that those benefits outweigh the losses, and I'm looking forward to some changes before we see our final bill.
Well, thank you so much to our experts that we had in the studio today. Becky Hultberg is the president and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Joshua Weinstein is with North Rim Benefits Group. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week and talking about the 5-year Arctic plan. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.